Welcome to the Nui Tech People podcast. My name is James McDonald. I spend my days interviewing some of the most innovative people working in the tech industry and hear some amazing stories. Each fortnight, we release a new episode sharing these conversations. This podcast aims to showcase the tech projects happening right here in Newcastle, provide key resources to help you grow your tech career, and share insights into the future of the Newcastle tech scene. Hope you enjoy this episode. On this episode of Nui Tech People, I interview Brendan Yell, Director of Twilio Startups and also Startup Grind in Sydney. We talk about his experience growing an online business, the benefits of working in Newcastle, and advice he gives to startup companies scaling their business. Hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome, Nui Tech People. Today we've got Brendan Yell, Director, APAC and US West Coast for Twilio Startups. Welcome, Brendan.
Cool. Thanks, James. Great to be here.
Mate, good to have you on. I've known you for a number of years now from the early days of Nui Startups. For those that don't know who you are, let me give people an overview of who you are, and let's start there, and then we'll go into your backstory because that's a pretty interesting story.
Yeah, sure. So I currently run the startup program for Twilio, but I don't like the term, but I suppose you could call me a serial entrepreneur. I've been a tech founder most of my career. Decided to take a little break from doing that. Went on tour with a rock band called INXS, and then got involved with startups and just felt like I had something to offer. And I'd love seeing people get things going. So it's I think I've got the best job in the world.
Yeah, nice. Mate, for a best job in the world, how do we get to there? Like, that didn't come by choice, by chance. You've obviously had a really strong backstory, which put you in a position to grab a role like this, mate. If we can go back in time, how did it all start out?
Well, where I ended up, well, after taking a break, if you remember, there's a Newcastle-based accelerator called Slingshot.
Yeah.
They heard I was living in the area and asked me to mentor. I didn't even really know what that was, but mentored batch one of Slingshot up here in Newcastle. When that program finished, one of the startups said to me, "So Yelly, what do we do now?" And I'm like, "I don't know, like demo day. I don't know. I've never been involved in one of these accelerator programs before. However, TechCrunch Disrupt is on in 2 weeks. Why don't we all go and exhibit at TechCrunch Disrupt in Startup Alley? I've done that before. I can guide you. Let's do it." So I took four of the teams over to San Francisco. We rented a house in a shitty little neighborhood. But it was near the convention center. They all exhibited at Startup Alley. And when I was there, I met some of the people from SendGrid. Now SendGrid ended up getting acquired by Twilio. So about 6 months later, they reached out to me and they said, "Look, you seem to love startups. You seem to happy to give to the community. We're looking for your role. We know you're based in Australia, but would you like to do it?" And that's kind of how it all happened. So if it hadn't been for Slingshot I didn't have any equity in these startups. I just wanted to help them out. And I think sometimes if you go in with the attitude of how can you help people, good things will happen. You don't know what's going to happen, but good things will happen. So it actually really all comes back to Slingshot. So I'm very, very thankful for working with those guys. And I've still have a great connection with them. I helped mentor the Qantas Accelerator that they ran. And they're still very much based here in Newcastle.
Yeah, Trent and Craig have done a lot for the area. Probably don't get the acknowledgement that they deserve, right? It's not easy to try to run something out of Newcastle. There's obviously easier options to go run in New Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane in Australia, or even bigger if you go internationally, but they've made a real play to try to help the area. And who are the four companies in that, in number one?
There was Fusion. Who else was there? There was the sports database one. I'm trying to think who the other ones were. but they were great founders. Especially with Trent and Craig setting up Slingshot here, you know, I think it's more accepted now to be outside of Silicon Valley, to be outside of Sydney. When they did it, it was a bit, you know, everyone was unsure whether it was going to work. But when they had the demo day up here in Newcastle and all the teams presented, they had people from all the top VCs from Sydney all came up to Newcastle to watch the demo day. So look, Newcastle has got a lot going for it. The university, I think, is a massive asset. And I think we should always think back to the university. This is a tech business. You need smart people to build these things. And we're competing not just with Sydney or Silicon Valley, but with startup ecosystems all around the world. Yeah. There are startups in Myanmar, Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore, and then, of course, all the usual suspects, Tel Aviv, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, Seattle. So, But you can run a startup from anywhere these days. I think that's what's awesome. There's no doubt during this period that is even more apparent, that it just doesn't matter where you are. I mean, you've got Canva, now what, $6 billion company based in Sydney, have no offices really outside, no offices in the US. They have no plans to do that. Yeah. They run this global company from Surry Hills. So you can do it from anywhere these days.
Yeah. I was about to touch on that. Mate, this the pandemic that's gone on. I know there's a lot, definitely more companies that are accepting from working from home. You're obviously working with a startup team, and they tend to be more forward thinking when it's coming to these things anyway. But more traditional companies are starting to accept working from home as normal practice. Do you think that will, on that talent part or starting a company, how do you think that will affect, you know, going forward?
Oh, I think we're going to see long-term changes around that. I think the fact that you can do your job from anywhere. I mean, we have a distributed team now. We plan to get together hopefully in January next year. Although if that's unlikely to happen, funny enough, we're planning to have like a 5-hour Zoom call in the next couple of weeks just to build that sort of team, to have everyone aligned in the same way. But there's no doubt, you know, why would you be in a high rent apartment in Sydney when you don't need to be? You know, why you could have a better lifestyle, more affordable, and there's great talent everywhere. It's not limited to the big cities. And if you can hire these people at a lower cost because they're distributed now, and maybe they just come in twice a year into the office, you know, I think that change is going to stay.
You got really good exposure to the US. In Newcastle, we're always candidate short from a tech perspective, not enough tech talent in Newcastle for local businesses. Do you think US companies will become a competitor for our talent as well? Do you think there'll be opportunities for USD, companies in the US paying USD to people from Australia to work remotely? Do you think that will become an issue for us?
As far as competitive talent, yeah, absolutely. And it's going to go both ways. We could hire, you could hire a marketing, a digital marketing expert in Austin, Texas, or, Twilio could hire someone in Lake Macquarie. So it's going to go both ways.
Yeah, I just think that USD and the differentiator there, they might be able to pick up somebody cheaper, right? And I think it'll be interesting.
I mean, with the San Francisco-based companies, the biggest problem is this competition for talent, mm-hmm. right? That's why all these Facebook, Google, they all offer these ridiculous perks and free snacks and gym memberships and all these things because they're competing so hard for talent. I was on a call with San Francisco this morning, and the comment was about San Francisco rents are plummeting. They are falling through the floor because no one needs to be there anymore. In fact, I've got a friend of mine who works at Zendesk.
Yeah.
He is now doing month-by-month Airbnbs, just traveling around the country because he doesn't need to be in San Francisco anymore.
Fantastic. And that'd be cheaper than the rent.
Much cheaper. I mean, I lived there in 2004 to about 2006. The rents were much cheaper, but now until recently, they were just like absolutely ridiculous. So why do you need to be there? I mean, is it access to capital? Are they smarter people there? None of those things really apply anymore. I mean, if you look at the top four VC firms in Australia, so Blackbird, Airtree, Square Peg, RightClick, they've now got a combined about $4.5 billion in capital. I mean, their biggest problem is finding startups to deploy it to. Yeah. They have to deploy the capital. That's their model. They can't just sit on it. You know, you used to go to San Francisco for capital. Now, we had capital here in Australia, but it was all very much geared around real estate. And to some degree, it still is.
Definitely Newcastle.
Right, definitely, right? So now we do have VCs in Australia with capital, but also understand the business. They understand the tech business. They understand SaaS. They understand customer acquisition. They understand these models. So that's a great opportunity for us. You don't need to go to the Valley to get that capital anymore. Sometimes I think we're a little too reliant on capital and VCs. And maybe that's a media thing. You know, people read an article, two guys in Brisbane raised $5 million on an idea. Now, usually when you dig into that article, it's never actually the case. But people are like, well, I've got an idea. Where's my $5 million? You know, and they have these unrealistic expectations. So I do feel sometimes founders don't get far enough along just bootstrapping their own business before they go and raise capital.
Yeah.
You should be able to get to a place where you build a product, got some customers, and really what you need the capital for is to like throw fuel on that fire and really blow it up.
Yeah, I think that ideas is, everyone's got ideas, but it's the execution part, right?
Absolutely.
And it takes something to actually pull that together, right? And you do see those people that have had success bootstrapping to a point, that they've had to grind and find a way to make it work, find a way to get those first customers. And then, as you said, the fuel on the fire with the money, as opposed to, I need the money to build a team, to build a product, to then find the customers. And yeah, it's a much riskier play, right?
Well, it is all about risk. And being a founder is not for everybody. Really, you might want to work in a high growth company like a Twilio or a Zendesk or a Salesforce or someone like that. But being a founder where you're sitting in a room by yourself trying to build something while you're not getting paid. I remember I had a day with ShopFree, which I founded back in 1999, where I'd mucked something up in the code and I'd worked all day. Now, at the end of that day, I was actually behind where I'd started from. Now, not only was I behind, I didn't get paid as well for that day. And it's depressing. You're like, my mate over there at Westpac, he got paid. I didn't get paid. I worked my butt off and I've still got to fix this stuff tomorrow. So it's really hard. And you have moments where you're like, why am I doing this? I should have just gone to Deloitte and got a nice little job and wear a suit and go in and get paid every month and not have to stress about it all.
Yeah.
So it's not for everybody. But if you do want to take that risk and build something, you can do it.
Yeah. A lot of the people I work with, a lot of people that are listening to the podcast are tech talent or tech Newcastle. Most of them are working for a company, not their own company. But there's a lot of them I speak to that have really good ideas, have really good talent, and you know, they work on something on the side. How do you feel about that? Working on something on the side while you're employed, you know, building something that, you know, that you're doing after hours, a bit of a pet project, and then sort of seeing how that goes. Is that something you think is a positive way of looking at it, or is that you'd rather see somebody all in?
I honestly think everybody should have some sort of side hustle
that
they're thinking about. Currently, I reacquired the name shopfree.com. I'm rebuilding that as a side hustle. I haven't really told anyone about it, but I'm doing it. Our team of five startup people right now, three of us are building a little side hustle. Weirdly, the other two, I put a note in the team doc this morning just saying, hey, Molly and Frank, I want you to start thinking about an idea. I want you to build a pitch deck for that idea. Just it keeps you in touch with what it's like to be a founder. I think when you step away sometimes, and the startup ecosystems have people around it, and they're all necessary people, subject matter experts and VCs and mentors and advisors and angels, all these sort of people. Sometimes they forget actually what it's like to be a founder and how hard it is. So I think by having that side hustle, it just kind of keeps you thinking. So I would highly recommend it for everybody. I mean, if you think about the startup Camplify, born here out of Newcastle, those guys had that idea for quite a while. And it wasn't until the NRMA Accelerator came along, they're like, hey, we could make this work. And in fact, through the program, they still worked their day jobs. And it wasn't until it started to move a little bit, they went, no, we're committing to this now. So Camplify, a great success story out of Newcastle, really did start off as a side hustle.
Yeah, Lift and Go were the same thing with Kevin as well. Like another, they're probably two of the biggest success stories in Newcastle as well.
Yeah.
I know the exact same thing there. Kevin was employed locally here and same thing. So I like that. I think also there's a lot of employers that like tinkerers. So people that, you know, if you're a dev, you don't just come to work and you're a dev and then outside of work, okay, I'm done with that. But the people that are building their own little projects on the side, it's the easiest way to, you know, continue to grow. But also for junior people, it's the easiest way to show you that you've got some skills, right?
Yeah, and it depends on your risk profile. So Justin from Camplify was really conservative in the early days about whether to give up his day job because he was married and had a mortgage. Now, when I started ShopFree, I was single and lived at home with my parents. So my risk profile was very different, let's say, to what it is now, where I'm married and I have three kids and have a mortgage. So your ability sometimes, like, is it harder to do a startup when you've got married and kids and mortgage? Yeah, it is. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you can't do it, but you have to kind of manage it a little bit different way. If you're 20, you're at university, you're living at home with mom and dad, and if it all turns to shit, well, everything's okay.
Yeah. And I think people, I agree 100%. But I do also think that once you've got those people that are a little bit older, yeah, you might have mortgage or kids, like you've also built up a wealth of experience. Like there's this untapped talent pool there where people are like, oh, to be a founder, you've got to be a hoodie wearing, you know, skate shoes wearing, you know, young 20-year-old that, you know, is a dev, and that's the only way, right? It's where there's these people are a little bit older, more experienced. You've got all the skills in the world. You've learned mistakes maybe not to do as well. And if companies can sort of tap into that sort of talent or skill set, I think there's plenty of options there or plenty of opportunity.
And a network as well.
Yeah.
Your network is super important. Now, do I know the marketing director of Coca-Cola in Australia? No, I don't. How long do you think it would take me on email to find that person through my network? I'm telling you, not very long. I could probably do it before the end of the podcast because I know people. I've built relationships over years. If I'm a startup that has something for Coca-Cola, now that might take me months to track that person down to get a meeting. However, you know, with a bit of agent experience and network, you know, I could email my buddy Andrew Lockwood, who's been in media all his life. He would know that person. I could have not only know who that person is, I could have a warm intro to that person, you know, within an hour. Very, very different. Speed is really important in startups. It is a race. And that, you know, if it takes you 3 months to get that first contract as opposed to 3 years, very different results, right? So the speed aspect is important and network is important. You know, I mentor around 300 startups a year around the world. I host the pitch competition at Web Summit in Portugal, the Rise in Hong Kong, at Collision in Toronto, Canada. And all of these startups, a lot of the mentoring I do is just connecting them to other people that can help them out. You know, I'd say 90% of the mentoring is just connecting them to other people. You should go talk to these people. Have you seen what they've done? Go copy their customer acquisition model. Usually 10% of the startups, and maybe are like, oh, I know this space, I can help you out. But most of it is me connecting them to other people that can help them out because I've got a network and they don't.
Yeah, nice. Now, you mentioned ShopFree a couple of times. For those that don't know, you know, your story around the ShopFree, can you give people a quick overview?
Yeah. So ShopFree was the company I started in 1999. It was my second company. I was in a radio station in Melbourne helping them with their website. And I saw this opportunity. They had a whole lot of, they had packets of chips there. And I was like, why are there chips here? What are you doing? You give them away. And they're like, yeah, we give them away. I'm like, what, on air? And they're like, no, we drive around and we give them out at events. And I was like, okay, why do you do that? They're like, no, brands pay us to give away samples. And in fact, we're always getting requests to give away samples, but we can only fit so many in the four-wheel drives we send around. And I suppose I'm always interested where there's a demand for something that's not being fulfilled. So I had the idea to give away samples on the internet, and I did a little sort of, you know, back of napkin kind of thing. I was like, okay, well, if they're handing out samples at a train station, they've got to put a person there, have a supervisor deliver the samples, probably pay the train station. I figured out it was probably costing them about $3 per sample to get that into someone's hand. Yet when they walked down the street, if they weren't into that sample, it would go in the bin. And I figured if I could send it to someone, a dollar, and I could, I would get sort of, you know, the company would pay to have that sample distributed. That's a dollar. And then I thought, a dollar for me. I thought, this is a business. So within 3 months, I really like absolutely did a minimum viable product. The lean startup thing wasn't a thing. Then I just thought the idea was that good that I had to rush it to market. In 3 months, I got it launched. And I launched it in August 1999, same month as Google. And it kind of took off. We had got a lot of free publicity. We're on A Current Affair and Say Tonight. And I did interviews with people like Darren Hinch. We're on ABC News. We were kind of everywhere. We got a lot of free press. So that started in Australia, and then I took that to the US. I had to acquire the domain name shopfree.com.
How much was that back in the days?
Well, while I was trying to acquire it, someone bought and sold it for 125 grand. So I'm like, I'm out.
Yeah.
However, I kept at it, and this company that had bought the name, who were trying to set up like a Shopify kind of thing, they ended up choosing a different name, which was Free Commerce instead of ShopFree. I bought that one for $14,000. And when they agreed to the amount, I couldn't, like, my fingers wouldn't move. I couldn't type it in quick enough. And I knew that by having a great domain name, you know, the three biggest words in domains are sex, shop, and free. Well, we had two of those. We thought that was pretty good. So, yeah, I did that what, you know, a lot of Aussies do, which is, you know, I moved to San Francisco because I thought that's what I needed to do. Funny enough, when I got to San Francisco, I realized that all of ShopFree's clients with direct marketing agencies, they were all in New York.
Yeah, right.
So I was actually in the wrong spot. You got to go where your customers are. However, I love this, you know, the San Francisco scene. It was so much fun. We were at the Google Float Party.
Yeah, wow.
I wish I'd bought the shares. They were $53 that day. They're now at $1,500. So I should have spent some money on some Google shares. But just being there a part of that ecosystem was amazing. And I think what was really interesting, because you're hanging out, like you're brushing shoulders with millionaires and billionaires. And it seems really strange. But in that world, especially with like Larry and Sergey at Google, currency in that world was ideas. Like, what are you working on? Like, what are you trying to do? Like, money was irrelevant. I think there was this assumption that if you're here, everyone's going to be fine financially. So the currency for them was, what's your idea? What do you think the opportunity is? So that was a really amazing thing to be a part of and see.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a completely different to most places, right, where it's, you know, it's a, how much money do you have and all the other questions and how big's your house, and whereas the actual ideas and the fact that they've got the smarts to execute on those type of ideas is phenomenal.
It's just and you roll into that in Australia where we have a little bit of this sort of tall prop poppy syndrome.
Yeah.
There's a guy I know who did very well at buying and selling businesses, a guy called Brad Sugars. Now, Brad lives on the Gold Coast and he also had a house in LA. He owned a yellow Ferrari in both places. He was stopped at the lights one time in LA and this homeless guy walks across and he's kind of feeling a little guilty, right? He's a homeless guy and he's in a yellow Ferrari, you know? And the homeless guy goes, well done, mate. That's awesome. Love your work. He said the same thing happened on the Gold Coast. Guy walked past, wanker, you know, and just a very different attitude. So, you know, I think sometimes we should look to see what the opportunity is as opposed to trying to sort of knock people down, because building a business is hard and it's very hard to do it by yourself. I remember having many moments with ShopFree where I just felt like I was packing into a scrum, like a football scrum, but I was the only one there.
Yeah.
It was just me. I was like, come on, you can do this. So you have those moments, and that emotional roller coaster of a startup, that happens like month to month, but it happens week to week, but it happens hour to hour.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really fast emotional roller coaster. You have wins, you have losses, but you're just moving forward. You know, they often say running is like the art of falling, but
yeah,
you stop forward. Yourself falling each time by taking another step. I mean, that's probably the best analogy for starting a company I could find.
Yeah, right. Nice. And then, so you're in San Fran, company was building, and then you're able to exit?
I had a funny exit. We licensed the database. We had a database of close to 1 million. We licensed that off to an agency. They ran that for 5 years. They paid us royalties. And at the end of 5 years, the domain name came back to me. So it was kind Fantastic. Of cool. We realized that we actually didn't need to be in San Francisco as well. And when you know rents were high, our customers were in New York, they didn't even really know where we were. They didn't really care. We had a lot of deals with the affiliate agencies, so that would, you know, it just didn't matter where we were. So before we left for San Francisco, my wife and I bought a place in Bonnells Bay.
And
just as a, like, I don't know if it was an investment. It was just like, well, we'll have somewhere if we get back. So we got back from San Francisco and thought we'll just rent an apartment in North Sydney, and Sydney real estate had gone nuts. And we're like, we'll just go move to Bonnells Bay.
Yeah.
And it was very, very strange, like being out of Sydney. I was so in that bubble for so long, and it took me a while to adjust to it. And it's just the best thing we've ever done. And we're now in Brightwaters. You know, the kids can go paddling in their kayaks, you know, from the backyard. So I think it's the best of both worlds. I did, when I moved here, try to sort of seek out the people that were in tech just so I could have lunch with them to bounce ideas off with. Sometimes you're not looking for people to tell you what to do. It's just like, I'll catch up with you and we'll just have a chat and just talk about things. So I think having a network of people around you that you can bounce ideas off is really valuable. I remember when I started ShotFree and I was, you know, by myself, I didn't really feel like I had anyone to bounce ideas off, you know, and that's very different now. We do have these startup communities and these startup ecosystems. And if you want to get involved, I highly encourage you to. You could be a mentor, an angel investor. You could be a subject matter expert. So you don't need to, you know, if you know how to do digital marketing or how to do branding, it doesn't mean you have to know about startups, but you can come in as a subject matter expert. And I think, you know, if you just come in with this attitude of how can I help, I think that will solve a lot of things.
Well, as you said before, I think if you tie that back into what you said earlier about networks, right? Networks are probably the most important thing to having some success, right? You're not going to be the expert in everything, but if you've got a network and you can be put in touch with the right person, that's the most important thing. As you said, sitting down for a coffee, shooting the shit, having a beer, that type of thing. You know, a lot of things come from those type of conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as I mentioned before, people do forget how hard it is to do a startup. And just having that network, I think, really helps. And if you can just be that person that helps out, like I still don't know really why I took those startups to San Francisco. I just wanted to help them. I just wanted to see them be successful. And luckily I had, you know, it resulted in some good fortune for me. So I think if you can come into these startup ecosystems with this attitude of how can you help, I just think it great things will happen.
Yeah, there's a lot to for that providing value up front and then just seeing what happens. You make your own luck, I guess. Like things have the world has a funny way of, you know, turning things around and then paying off, right?
Absolutely.
So your experience, you've experienced startup scene in Newcastle here, but like Sydney, San Fran. What do you say, like you've been around the Newcastle scene for a while. It's obviously small and we've had a few companies now doing reasonable sized rounds. What have you seen? What's your current take on the market here?
I think there's a good sense of community. I think because it's small, people can help each other. I actually find that the Sydney ecosystem is kind of too big and it's a little bit competitive sometimes. I think that Newcastle's size and its affordability makes it a great place. You've also got talent coming through the university. Until recently, you had overseas students as well who were talent, and there's an opportunity to work with those people. So it's got all the right ingredients. We'll probably be great to tap into a few more high net worths that can do that angel investing. You know, I'm talking small checks, 15 grand, 20 grand, to just help someone get through that initial period. They might need to hire some tech talent. I mean, not everybody can do it for free, right? So I think some more angels here would probably be the one thing that I think that's missing. And it's not about propping it up. It's just about giving those early stage startups a little bit more of a helping hand to get to that next stage.
Yeah, I agree. As we talked about before, bootstrapping is all well and good, and it's really good to see somebody, you know, bootstrapping to a certain point. But at some point, you do need money, right? You need money out of that, whether it be throwing marketing, whether it be to hire somebody to actually execute on something. Yeah, everyone needs some form of revenues at some stage, and a lot of that time is before you actually do get paying customers.
Yeah, I mean, I do a little bit of angel investing. It's super hard, like trying to pick a winner because there's a million reasons why a company will fail. There's just so many reasons why it won't work. The two active investments I've got at the moment, one is called Landmarks ID, which is like a data enrichment for geolocation. So let's say you've got an app, let's say you're Ladbrokes, and you want to know when people walk into a licensed venue, this will, via an API, will trigger location-based events. So I've gone to a racetrack, I've gone to a gym, I've gone to a shopping center, that kind of stuff. The other one is called Etch, which is a collaborative workspace slash kind of knowledge store. And the reason I invested in both of those, especially in Etch, was when I chatted to the founder, Ash, every time I asked him questions about acquiring customers, he seemed to have an answer for it because he'd done tests on LinkedIn ads and different things to find out who his customers would actually be. You know, if I meet with around about 300 startups per year, probably 295 of them have developed a great product that solves a problem that will, you know, if people buy it, would make money. But what they have to do then is actually acquire customers. And it's about their ability to cost effectively acquire customers that will determine whether it succeeds or fails.
Yeah.
If you can take your cost per acquisition from $20 like down to $2, like that's the difference between, you know, hiring more people and spending more money on acquisition or shutting your doors. And then look, it happens. Startups sometimes fail. I've seen it happen many times. Weirdly, though, I often see that the startup will go, oh, the VCs wouldn't back us, or they didn't understand it. Often it was just their ability to acquire new customers at a cost-effective way that they didn't get right. And I see founders, they're like, hey, man, I've built my product's twice as good as theirs. It's half the price. Where's the customers? They're like, well, unfortunately, the best products don't always win.
No.
You know, is Salesforce the best CRM in the market? I don't know. But it's number one, right? Are there better products? Maybe. I don't know. Like, is Oracle the best, you know, enterprise database software? I don't know. Maybe there's a free version that they happen to own that's better than their enterprise level. Maybe. I don't know. But Oracle, if you ever meet an Oracle salesperson, that is a sales-driven organization.
Oh, yeah.
Right? They are hardcore. But that's what the business is about. Yeah, you have to build a product that solves a need that people are prepared to pay for, that offers some sort of value. But how are you getting those new customers? How are you finding them? How are you upselling them? How are you retaining them? How are you winning them back?
Yeah, that upselling as well, like SaaS solutions in general, right? Freemium models, you know, seem to be very hot, right? I can get somebody on board for free, but how are you going to actually convert them? When are you going to get them to take their credit card out, put those details in, and send over some money, right? Like that's a very real problem.
I'll give you an example. There was an app that I installed about 2 years ago, and it was one of those forced saving apps. So what it does, connects to your bank account. It rounds up each purchase, and that you can invest in shares, or you can pay off a credit card, or donate it to charity, or whatever. Right? So I'm thinking, I spend a lot of money on my credit card, and a bit of forced saving, never a bad thing. So I installed the app. I searched for the app in the app store. I installed the app. I registered. I confirmed my email address. I went back to the app, and it said, "What are your banking details?" And I was like, "I don't know. I've been using my thumb for 2 years. I got no idea what my banking details are." Right. So I didn't go any further. Now, there's a million reasons why people get stopped in an onboarding process, right? It could be my kids are fighting in the corner. I've just hopped off the bus. I'm not ready to buy now. I don't have my banking details, right? Now, it took them 9 months to send me an email to say, hey, you can just, you know, ring 1-800-ST-GEORGE and get your bank details and you'll be saving away with our app. 9 months it took them to email me. And in that period, they're doing more ads on Google, more ads on Facebook, right? So they've got... I'm their best customer, and there I am stuck in the process, and they didn't get me on board.
Yeah, you're 80% away through a sales funnel, right?
Absolutely. And sales funnels, you know, are important. I do that. I put my hands up in the shape of a funnel all the time when I talk to startups, going, tell me what it looks like. The best startups will have a very good answer about that. They'll say, I get my customers from here. This is what they look like. This is how much it costs. This is how I upsell them. This is the lead magnet. This is how I win them back. You know, that is just, it's. I wouldn't even say it's a dirty part of the business. It's just a necessary part of the business. And if you don't do it, I'm sorry, you can't just sit there. People don't care enough to just knock your door down.
Can feel dirty when you're clearly in somebody else's sales funnel and it's not done well. And you're getting text messages unprompted. You're getting 5 emails within 2 days. It's like that. Getting that right from an early touch point perspective is so important.
You know, we did some research and 90% of businesses think that they do that piece well. Weirdly, 90% of customers think they do it badly.
Yeah.
There's a massive disconnect because we all think we're sending the right message to the right customer at the right time as marketers, but so often we're not. You know, I'll give you a great example. There's an electronics good retailer here in Australia. They sent me this text last year and it said, "Hi, Brendan." I was like, "Oh, nice personalization. 10% off dishwashers." I was like, "When did I ever tell you I wanted a dishwasher? Like, in 10%? Really? It's not exactly floating my boat." Yet there's another retailer in Australia, the Oxford Shop. I buy a few jackets from them. They sent me a text message and it said, "Hey, Brendan, here's a $20 voucher for the spring collection." So I went into the store and I said, "Hey, what's up with the voucher?" And the person said, "Hey, you can buy a short shirt for $21, like, and only pay a dollar." Like, I was like, "Wow, this is good. Keep sending me text messages. This is great." So, you know, I think if you're going to, you know, communicate to people, you have to offer them some value or convenience. And I think marketers so often think that they're way more important to their customer than what they are.
Yeah, I completely agree. Completely agree. My previous life was email marketing manager back in the days when email was the thing before social one.
Well, look, email is still an important part of the mix.
It's probably coming back, I think. It's coming back to importance, but people are more protective of their inbox these days than they used to be.
Yeah, for company communications, it's the preferred method. And it just depends what it is, right? So if it's archival as opposed to urgent, you know, so if it's archival, email is awesome. If it's urgent, then, you know, text message is the way to go. So let's say I just purchased some new home contents insurance. I don't want that policy sent to me on WhatsApp or a text message. I want that on email.
Yeah.
So for a lot of communications, email is still really important. There's new platforms like Superhuman and Hey, which are making that more efficient and a better experience. Obviously, in the Twilio product suite, we've got SendGrid, which was their acquisition last year, which has customers like Uber and Airbnb. So if you need high deliverability and get your message in the inbox, then, you know, we have a solution for that. But email is still a really important part of the mix, but you have to use it the right way.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think it is actually probably, it's gone from email used to be really important and social sort of took over it, and then email's coming back again because, you know, that organic search or, you know, the ability to get in somebody's inbox is so much, I guess, easier than getting in front of their news feed on Facebook, Instagram, whatever they're on these days. And people are more protective of it, so.
Yeah, they are. And social has got, you know, I mean, there's a bit of social media fatigue at the moment. It's still a very important part of the mix. And I think if you have a product where you know exactly the persona of your customer, you know, my customer is 35 years old. She's female. She lives in a non-capital city. Facebook and social media is a great place to target those people. If you've got a product where people know what they want, you know, Google's probably a better choice. So, you know, let's say it's a blanket with arms, like, do I know that I want a blanket with arms? Probably not. So maybe social media is the way to go. But if you've got a product where you know that there's people are actively searching for it, then, you know, so social is profiling, and think about Google search as like demand, like people want it. So, you know, again, if startups can get that piece right, it's just the difference between success and failure.
Yeah, completely agree, mate. You're obviously extremely busy, man. As you said, you're dealing with the US time zones. You start your days really early. From a productivity perspective, how do you manage your day? Is there productivity tools you use? Is it you in email? Is it WhatsApp? How do you manage your day? Is there any apps or from a holistic perspective, from productivity, how would you?
Yeah, look, there's a couple of things. Obviously, we're all probably suffering a bit of Zoom fatigue at the moment. So we do no Zoom Fridays. So Friday, no Zoom calls. And then the other thing we do is every third week, with no calls. Like, no, so we can get things done. If it's urgent, it's customer facing, sure, that would happen. But just to try and reduce it, I think it's very easy to jump on Zoom calls a bit too often. We use Slack. I don't love it, but it sort of is effective. Obviously, I still use email a lot. I try to block out bits of time. So I actually operate on a couple of different devices. So if I want to go write a document, I've got a little MacBook Air that I take, and it's got nothing else installed on it but Google Docs, and I'll go and write that doc. So I try very hard to kind of block out the interruptions, because it's just so easy to just, you know, ping. I think I've got a short attention span anyway. You know, this sort of world we live in of constant notifications is certainly not good for me. So I try to shut those off is probably the main thing that I do.
Yeah, nice. Obviously, you've had some success in your career, but you're continuing to grow and learn from other people, obviously networking. Is there any personal people in particular that you think, hey, definitely worth listening to, definitely worth reading their books or and that type of thing?
I'm reading a book called Hooked at the moment, which is about developing habit-forming products. Has a lot of case studies, so it's not too preachy. So I'm really kind of really enjoying that. I think the Angel book by Jason Calacanis, he's probably the world's most famous angel investor, put $100,000 to Uber, turned it into $100 million. But he's also invested in things like Robinhood and some other great apps. His podcast called This Week in Startups, I think, is worth listening to.
Yeah.
There's a lot out there. There's a lot of media out there. And I think you have to kind of pick and choose what you decide to listen to and at what stage, right? So if you're an early stage founder just thinking about what you're trying to do, Gary Vaynerchuk would be awesome to listen to. You can outgrow Gary V though, and then move
he
on.
He actually talks about that in his podcast. He actually says, he's like, hey, I don't want people to listen to me for their career. I want them to take my advice and run with it and then never come back.
That's awesome. We did an event with him in Hong Kong a couple of years ago. That guy walks the walk. He does talk the talk, but he walks the walk. He was in the same hotel as us. He was in the Grand Hyatt in Hong Kong. Yeah. He was doing 5 o'clock breakfast meetings, and he was still, I remember one night he was still with a bunch of students at 10 p.m. that night. So he does, and he gives. He will stop and give anybody his time. In fact, leaving one of the venues with him was the hardest thing I've ever had to do because he just kept giving. He just kept giving. So look, there's Gary V lovers and haters. I'm a lover. I'm a fan, but I think you can outgrow him. But he does preach. He does what he preaches. He gives and he helps people. And I think he's a great inspiration to a lot of people. And apparently he's found this real young audience now on TikTok. Yeah, he has a videographer that follows him around D-Rock, but he's apparently been putting it all out to TikTok. And he's got this whole new audience now of people where he's saying, you don't have to do it the way your parents did it. The world is different today. So I think that's very empowering. It doesn't mean everybody should go start a business or everybody should be a YouTube star. But if you want to do it, he does give you some ideas and some tools to make that happen.
Any other advice you'd provide for people? Obviously, we've got a more Newcastle tech orientated listener base for this, but any other, high level advice you'd provide people?
Yeah, look, I think founders make the mistake of thinking that they are the customer, and it's rarely the case. Usually they're not the customer. So thinking that you are the customer, I think it can be a mistake. And I do see that a lot. And I would say, even I fell into this a bit with ShopFree, where customers would point out things on the website. And I was like, no, that's not the case. And I realized I hadn't actually been on my own website as a customer for months. So I think the expression used to be eat your own dog food. I think there's probably another expression that's more popular now. But just that concept of using your own product and then also listening to users. I think sometimes you think you've got the perfect solution to it, but the customers will tell you different. Like a great example was Justin.tv, right? So Justin was a guy in San Francisco, strapped a camera to his head, and Justin.tv became his life. And you'd tune in and there's Justin skateboarding or whatever, right? He decided after 2 years he'd had enough of that, and he decided what he'd actually built was quite a cool video streaming platform. So they relaunched it as a video streaming platform called Justin.tv. And all of a sudden, all this usage went up massively. And they're like, what is it? What are these people doing? Like, we thought people could stream board presentations and, boring stuff like that. And they found out there were gamers on there. They were streaming themselves live and other people were watching. And they were this close to switching all those gamers off and just banning them. What they decided to do was spin it out into a gaming-only streaming platform. And that was called Twitch. And Amazon and Google had a bidding war over that. Now, Amazon ended up buying it. It was actually reported that Google had made the purchase, but Amazon came in again and bought that platform. And they didn't start to create a gaming streaming platform, but that's what the users were using. So paying attention to what they're doing, you might think this is your number one feature. Turns out this is what they're all doing on it, right? So just looking at that data and seeing what the customers are doing. I had a failed startup called Recipe Lover. And I spent about 90 grand of my own money and 3 months developing a feature where you could upload videos both to our platform and YouTube at the same time with chapters and annotations. The only problem with that feature is that only one person ended up ever using it, and that was me. So it wasn't like customers were beating my door down going, Brendan, Recipe Lover would be awesome if you just added this video upload feature. No, I thought that's what they wanted. I wasn't listening to the customer, wasn't listening to the request. And that startup, it failed. Eventually my wife, who's an accountant, came in and said, hey, how long is this going on for? And I'm like, why? She's like, well, this is what you've spent on it so far. And I was like, oh, wow. When you put it in one number, it does look like a lot, And eventually I just had to shut it down because I hadn't listened to the customer and I wasted too much money on features that no one cared about.
Yeah. I love that. I think there's plenty of advice you provide there. So, mate, I don't want to take up too much of your time. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Great to be here. Thanks, James. Cheers, man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Tech People. To stay up to date with all our episodes, our show notes, and past episodes, please visit www.newtechpeople.com.au. Thank you.